Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Today, journalist Angela Nagel talks about the alt-right and its light variant, and Middle Eastern scholar Laleh Khalili gives us the background on Trump's new national security advisor, H.R. McMaster. First, the alt-right. With the odious right-wingers Milo Yiannopoulos and Richard Spencer in the news, Angela Nagel, a Dublin-based journalist who's got a book on the topic forthcoming from Zero Books, finds herself in great demand. We're used to seeing right-wing extremists who aren't very photogenic and need to brush up on their social skills. Both Yiannopoulos, universally known as Milo, and Spencer are highly presentable in the conventional sense. Though he denies it, Spencer is a serious neo-Nazi. Milo's politics are harder to pin down. He seems more like a provocateur. He's gay, dresses dramatically, and brags about his taste for black men. And he has a Jewish ancestor. Those things get him denounced by the hardcore Nazis, but they seem to earn him a pass from some opinion leaders. Then, last week, an interview from last year in which Milo suggested that 13-year-olds are mature enough for sex was unearthed and circulated online. But that observation got him dropped from the speaking gig at the Conservative Political Action Conference, and he was forced to resign from Breitbart News. He also lost a $250,000 book contract with Simon & Schuster. But sex under the age of consent is apparently a deal-breaker for these characters. So who are the alt-right exactly? Here's Angela Nagel, who, aside from her forthcoming book, writes for Current Affairs, The Baffler, and Jacobin, to tell us more. We record this just as it was learned that Milo, who I guess we're all weary of giving him so much attention, but we're kind of forced to, resigned from Breitbart. You hadn't classed him as part of the heart of the alt-right, right?
Yeah, very much like any kind of group of subcultures, they're very, very picky about who gets to belong in which subgroup of it, you know. It's kind of like a bit of vegan punk kind of syndrome. So they get very annoyed if you include somebody who isn't pure kind of alternative right. So Richard Spencer, for example, was very pleased that Milo's career is destroyed now. He was kind of gloating about it on Twitter last night.
Now, is that just rivalry or is there something more to it than personal conflict?
I think there is something more to it. I mean, the hard alt-right, we'll say, is very open about its goals, which are white segregationist. Whereas somebody like Milo, I mean, you know, it's kind of hard to know exactly what he is for. But on many occasions, he kind of sounds like a liberal, really. He's never been convincing to me as a conservative. And, you know, he's in favor of free speech and stuff like that. Now, obviously, he throws in these things that you would expect from the far right here and there. But when he's actually putting forward a position, it's pretty kind of liberal stuff most of the time.
There are people who will denounce him as a Nazi. I'm not quite sure what that's based on. Is that a fair characterization?
No, it's not. I mean, see, well, it's a little bit difficult because he mixes very, very light-hearted stuff with, as I say, just he occasionally drops in these really shocking things. So, for example, I saw a lot of alt-right people, must have been about 2 weeks ago, sharing a video clip of one of his talks in which he was having a go at these women. Two of them were wearing headscarves and they were kind of heckling him. He was then shouting back and they one by one left the room to the chants of massive groups of men shouting USA, USA. And I mean, it really was totally a chilling scene, you know. So I can see why when people see stuff like that, I mean, that does have the feel of something kind of fascistic. But again, I mean, most of the time he's just sort of making fun of social justice warriors, making the case for free speech. For example, one of his recent talks, actually, I think it was the one just before the Berkeley one, or the one that was supposed to happen at Berkeley, he actually specifically said that the alt-right is basically identity politics for white people and that we should reject it.
In favor of what?
I don't know.
Are we looking for an ideological clarity that's just not there?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, he doesn't know. He contradicts himself all the time. And in fact, I used to listen to all of his podcasts, you know, and he often kind of, when he was in a lighter mood, basically admitted that he doesn't really know what he's for, you know. I remember, for example, him joking with a guest about how the whole Catholic thing is a little bit of an act. I mean, he didn't say it quite as outright as that, but he said, you know, I know that it annoys liberals. And, you know, he often says things like, I don't really care about politics. I only care about culture.
Well, right. Breitbart famously said, was it politics is downstream from culture?
Yeah. Yeah. And Milo said something like he likes Trump because he's the first truly cultural presidential candidate since Pat Buchanan.
A total Philistine, but very cultural. And before we get return to seriousness, I'm curious how you got into this pursuit, and do you worry about it damaging your sanity?
I do a little bit, actually. Although the fact that this has now gone mainstream is kind of benefit to nobody in the world except me, because suddenly my niche interest has, you know, now everyone wants to interview me and stuff. But it was about 8 years ago I started studying anti-feminist movements online. At that point, I was just seeing lots of it appearing in comment sections and things like that. But I could see that, you know, it was gathering some kind of pace and it started using a kind of common language. And so then I started looking at like 4chan and Red Pill, that kind of anti-feminist sort of neo-masculinist, all those kinds of MGTOW and all those kinds of things. They use that Red Pill metaphor, and so does the alt-right, which is more concerned with race. But really, it's all about civilizational decline. And obviously, the more anti-feminist right, the ones that are more preoccupied with the gender issues, believe that feminism is the thing that will bring about the decline of Western civilization, whereas people like Richard Spencer are more concerned with race.
Now, there's a point of view that these guys are social misfits, weird tech types who maybe live in their parents' basement and never get out of their underwear, never get out of the apartment. Didn't one of Alex Jones's people say that he never leaves his apartment? Yeah.
I know, Paul Joseph Watson. Well, I feel bad for that guy because even the alt-right make fun of him.
But is this true? Are they really this kind of marginalized, weird guy who just can't get dates and that's the fuel of resentment? Or is it broader than that?
It is broader than that, but there's definitely plenty of truth to that as well. I mean, if you look at the forums like Red Pill and things like that, if you look at any of the forums where they're discussing this stuff, one of their massive preoccupations when it comes to gender is the idea that with the decline of monogamy and traditional marriage, that there is a kind of a sexual hierarchy that has emerged among men in which larger groups of women compete for a smaller number of men. They are very aware. I mean, some of them like refer to themselves as beta males. And, you know, they're very aware that they are in the kind of group that women have no interest in. And they get incredibly angry about this. And I would say they make up the bulk of it. All right. But then you have, you know, other people kind of emerging that are, I don't know, a bit more presentable.
So how did it go from weirdos on 4chan to being something like a political movement? How did it grow?
It's very hard to say when things are happening in many different places at the same time. When it all started coming together, I mean, I guess it's a kind of an internet culture that's based around discussing taboo topics and particularly liberal taboos. So it's kind of easy to see. I mean, you know, if you're, for example, on a very kind of anti-feminist forum and you're discussing these ideas that the sort of everyone's going to be trans now and the traditional marriage has been ruined and all that kind of stuff, it's not that hard to see how you would get from there to the alt-right. And there's massive links between them all, just sharing each other's stuff and making the connections in terms of ideas that this is all about civilizational decline.
That's funny because they hardly seem like paragons of civilization themselves.
But that's always the case, though. I mean, you know, if you read about Nietzsche, who they all love, diseased and rejected and all the rest of it, but speaking about the sort of great men and glorifying that kind of stuff.
But, you know, Nietzsche was, for all his faults, remarkably erudite and a very fantastic writer. These guys are none of those things.
Yeah. I think Richard Spencer is pretty good at doing media stuff, and he's pretty articulate, and his ideas, he's kind of thought through his answer on a lot of things. Not everything, though. I was watching something recently with him. It was an Ask Me Anything, and somebody asked him, you know, they're obsessed with IQ, and somebody asked him something like, you know, if people have low IQ and they, you know, behave in a particular way as a result, does that mean that they have, that it's not their fault? In other words, that they don't have will. And he said, oh, that's a stupid question. And he just went on. Actually, it's a brilliant question because it's totally fundamental to their whole worldview, which is based on IQ. But actually, a funny thing is they also asked him, are Irish people white? Because apparently we're a low IQ kind of subset of white people.
I thought we saw that in the U.S. about 100 years ago. in favor of your whiteness. Spencer, he's quite a character. I saw him do an interview with a Vice reporter a few months ago in which he just kicked her around the block. She seemed to be a product of the whole Daily Show, eye-rolling irony, exasperation, reaction to the silly things that right-wing people say, but she was no match for him. He talked rings around her. What about his performance? Where did he learn to do that?
I don't know where he learned to do that. He seems like a naturally confident sort of person anyway. But I do remember him saying before that, I think it might have been around the time Obama got elected, but certainly that he was describing kind of a moment in which he and other like-minded people knew that the kind of conservative establishment in America was a dead end and it was absolutely over and they had to rethink everything. You know, so I do get the impression that throughout the last 8 years or so, like, those people have actually been thinking quite deeply about strategy and ideas, and, you know, they can't all be dismissed kind of intellectually.
Spencer wrote his master's thesis on Adorno, correct?
Right, yeah.
So he does have some kind of formal training in political philosophy.
Yeah, absolutely, and you can tell, you know, you can tell right away. And he's very interested in movements. I remember listening to an interview with him once in which he was talking about the neocons and how they started as sort of anti-Stalinist, you know, Trotskyists, and how they have now been kind of usurped. And so he's very aware of kind of like the life cycle of movements and why movements sort of have a spark at a particular time in history and why they then decline. And, you know, he's just, it's very obvious from interviews that he's thought a lot about this. He clearly has some knowledge of Marxist ideas. He's very aware of, in strategic terms, of the fact that in order to have a political movement, you first have to have consciousness. So his whole idea is that the first step is to create white consciousness so that white people will think of themselves as white. So that's their goal. I mean, that's the first goal, to create a white consciousness so that people think of themselves first and foremost, not in terms of class, gender, geography, religion, anything else, but whiteness.
Yeah, and as you've written, that race really is at the core of what they think about. There's not much else in their philosophy, is there?
No, I mean, they have this mantra, which is like, yeah, they like to repeat, you know, race is real.
And for those of us who are used to saying that race is a social construct, they'll have none of that.
No.
I'm speaking with a Dublin-based journalist, Angela Nagel. Terminology. There are people who object to the term alt-right who want to see Spencer and his crowd as nothing but just old-fashioned right-wingism. What do you think of the term? You use it. Why?
Well, they are something kind of new. They don't care as much about traditional moral conservatism, for example. I don't think they seem to care about it much at all. In fact, you know, I rarely hear them talking that much about it. I mean, they have the sense that we're in a kind of moral decline, but they think the reason for that is racial, basically. For them, everything goes back to race. But I think the fact that they don't care about the moral stuff does make them a little bit different. And also, they are kind of expert in, you know, being funny and, you know, memes, and their style is very different.
And they had none of the high culture pretensions of the early National Review.
Yeah, well, I love how much they hate the National Review. Gavin McInnes, who used to be with Vice and now has a show on The Rebel, the Canadian right-wing YouTube station, he always calls National Review a monocle-wearing conservatives.
They hadn't been that for a long time, though.
Yeah, but, you know, they've attacked them almost more than they bother attacking anyone on the left.
Well, sometimes I feel that way about liberals, so I can understand. And now, what about the relationship with the Trump administration? Trump has a mix of, you know, orthodox Republicans and what seem to be fellow thinkers. What's the relationship with Trump?
Well, they're all really pro-Trump. Trump is the thing that unites everyone from anti-feminists like Rush V, you know that guy?
Yeah. Return of Kings, is that the guy?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. He was started off as a sort of pickup artist guy, and now he's sort of grown a beard and does these long, kind of thoughtful YouTube videos.
And who is totally appalling.
Yeah, I mean, but see, again, this is what I find kind of interesting about them, and this is what I was trying to get at in the Jacobin piece. It's so incoherent, because this guy wrote a series of books called Bang. Like, his whole thing was go around the world trying to trick women into, you know, having sex with you, using social Darwinism and all these kinds of things. And then he says, you know, women shouldn't be promiscuous and people should return to the traditional marriage and stuff. You know, you can't have it both ways. What they really want is the sexual revolution for men and pre-sexual revolution for women, or something like that.
You also think it's important how these people relate to the social justice warriors, the kind of online, I don't want to call them left exactly, because they're not really, but, you know, people who police language, people who are policing behavior and thought. Could you talk about that relationship?
Yeah, well, again, to go back to Richard Spencer, I remember in an interview once he said, I love social justice warriors. I wish I could fund them or something. I wish I could find a way to fund them because they're so good for us. And it's absolutely true. I mean, Milo's fame would have been impossible if it weren't for them. All of these people have made their names on pointing out the absurdity and the funniness of the kind of wacky Tumblr end of, I don't know what to call it, sort of turbo liberalism or something.
Yeah, well, they're all more righteous than that, but they're also big Hillary fans. It's the contradiction of their philosophy I never quite understood.
Yeah, no, it doesn't make much sense. I mean, well, I suppose, I mean, if your politics are purely cultural, it kind of does make sense. I mean, she is a woman, and so what else do you need? And in terms of the way they interact with each other, the kind of, let's just call it the Tumblr left, if you like, just so that we can refer to it. It's fueling the opposition all the time, you know. And for really young people, say who are just like in their late teens now, who don't really know of any left before the one that they're experiencing, like through their peers and stuff, or maybe who spend a lot of time online. To them, the right looks like the fun place to be, you know, and the left looks like a terrible, humorless, you know, absurd, out-of-touch, weird world of ultra-sensitivity.
Which is less true among younger leftists, but this is, you know, I guess they see a lot of this on the Twitter and on the Tumblr.
Yeah.
And they also both, you know, it's often the case with apparently contradictory relationships, they have a common feature, which is their obsession with identity, whatever that means.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, they are, it's interesting, like, you know, when Milo said Donald Trump is great because he's sort of all about culture, the culture wars, and, you know, Milo has no interest in politics and so on. I mean, that would be a pretty typical attitude on both sides, you know. The attraction to Hillary is a cultural thing as well. You know, she's kind of almost just a symbolic figure for them.
And finally, I suppose we should be worried about these people. They are frightening, although their numbers are not that great. But they do have a man in the White House, in some sense. How do you go about fighting them without falling into their traps?
It's very tough. I really don't know. When you say we need to have a dialogue, it sounds like a very stupid thing to say, because obviously some of them are so nasty, you couldn't. But the thing is, right, there are massive numbers of people who would have just been like South Park fans 10 years ago, you know, who just have a sort of an anti-PC impulse, who are not particularly attracted to the left, we'll say, in general, but who aren't really that political. They might watch like one sort of alt-light video, and then the next time they go on YouTube, it'll be recommending to them 10 more alt-light videos, and then the next, and you know, and so on. It's very easy to go down the rabbit hole of, you know, into the far right, like pretty quickly, you know. And we have to think about, like, if a very young person, because it is, like, I think the age profile is pretty young, if they go into that world and they're being shown all this absolutely horrifying information, and as far as they're concerned, it's true, they don't have any reason to distrust it. How do you, like, how do they find information that is contrary to that, you know? Because the two kind of worlds are not mixing in any way. So I think, you know, people need to, one of the things is like, well, people who write certainly need to just do the boring, hard research of like actually showing why, you know, maybe a particular rumor is wrong or something like that, you know. I mean, that's just a small thing and kind of answer, but I do think that needs to happen because something has to kind of get in the way of when they're going down the hard right sort of rabbit hole. There needs to be something there that can give them a different view of the world, you know. And at the moment, there's no place where they can really get that.
And it has to be irreverent and funny and not earnest, I imagine.
Yeah. It's a lot to ask, but it's interesting, isn't it, that Milo, for the last year, there's been like demonstrations trying to shut Milo down, everyone trying to get him banned on everything, riots even at Berkeley. And the right had him shut down in 48 hours.
Yeah, well, he got fired and disinvited.
In 2 days. I mean, I think it might have even been less than 2 days. He got sacked from his job. He lost this massive book contract. I mean, his whole career was just destroyed. And up until that happened, I kind of was thinking, God, this guy is unstoppable, you know. You know, so I don't know. I mean, maybe... that would be worth thinking about. Why is that? You know, we get caught in this endless free speech debate and should you punch a Nazi, blah, blah, blah. But the thing is, whatever your feelings on free speech and violence and things like that, part of a political project must be that you have to convince people of your case, of your position. And I think too many people on our side feel that they are above actually doing that. Because they're around people who agree with them, as are people on the right. But, you know, so they don't feel that they need to actually argue the case for basic things. And as a result, people become very intellectually lazy and they don't actually know what to say when they're really challenged on things. So just to give one example, Milo was often on TV talking about the wage gap. And what would, at this time, he wasn't quite as famous. So somebody like Kate Smirthwaite or, you know, sort of like liberal British feminists would go on just taking it as a given that women are paid less than men for the same work, you know, and so on. And he would say with absolute confidence, this is a total myth, blah, 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 you know. And the problem is that there's truth to what he's saying, that that's not the nature of the wage gap, that men and women are being paid different for the same work. But it's also, you know, a position that makes no sense because he's saying it's not because they're women, it's because they get pregnant. But of course, you know, there's a connection between them getting pregnant and being women. So, you know, that kind of thing. Like, and those women were totally not ready for that challenge because to them, you know, anyone who would question this is just a total idiot. And you know, there's no point in even doing much work thinking about it. Or being prepared to be really fundamentally challenged. I think one of the good things about having sort of conservative parents is that you're used to actually fighting your position the whole time. Every time I go home to visit my parents, I have to fight my position. So I kind of grew up with that. And so to me, it just comes naturally. But I think far too many people on our side think that they don't have to argue for anything and haven't actually questioned really basic assumptions.
Well, I used to be a conservative long ago, so I'm practiced at arguing with myself. That was Angela Nagel. Her book on the alt-right, Kill the Normies, will be out in April from Zero Books. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break.
A branch of the linden is leafy and green. The Rhine gives its gold to the sea. But somewhere a glory of it's unseen. Tomorrow belongs to me. The babe in his cradle is closing his eyes. The blossom embraces the bee. But soon says I.
Come when the world is mine, tomorrow belongs to me.
some of Tomorrow Belongs to Me from the movie version of Cabaret. I'm not the biggest fan of musicals, to put it mildly, but I've always liked Cabaret a lot. The rise of the Nazis in Weimar Germany is one of the themes in the musical, and in this one, a young blonde specimen, a member of Hitler Youth, stands up in a beer garden and starts singing this song, based, I believe, on an old German folk ditty. It starts with an evocation of nature and morphs into an anthem in praise of the fatherland. One by one, other patrons of the beer garden stand and join in the singing. It's a chilling scene, and I dearly hope we're not living through some real-life version of it today. Next, Lalla Khalili. After the brief disastrous tenure of Michael Flynn as National Security Advisor, Donald Trump has appointed another military guy, H.R. McMaster, to succeed him. McMaster has gotten almost universally enthusiastic reviews. Why? Who exactly is he? Here's Lalla Khalili, who teaches Middle Eastern politics at the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London, to tell us more. Trump has chosen H.R. McMaster as his national security guy. What's his background?
Herbert McMaster is a fascinating figure, and part of the reason that he's a fascinating figure is because when I was doing my research on counterinsurgency, I found that he was one of the very few people that across the board, all the military officers who actually work in counterinsurgency, regardless of what their degree of cynicism was towards counterinsurgency as a doctrine, all respected him for his intelligence. Another factor about him that is quite interesting is that while a number of the more famous high-profile counterinsurgents were writing the counterinsurgency manual in, say, 2006, 2007, under the guidance of David Petraeus, McMaster was in the field fighting. He has a PhD in history and wrote a thesis, which has become a book called Dereliction of Duty, which is itself a fascinating book because it argues that the military officers, the high military officers of the U.S. did not do their duty. They vacated their duty to advise civilian politicians of what they were getting themselves into during the Vietnam War.
Yeah, now what do you make of that analysis?
There are several things about this that are quite interesting. One is the ways in which he discusses the organizational makeup of the National Security Council in the U.S. under John F. Kennedy. And one of the things that he says, which is one of the reasons it's very interesting that he has now become the National Security Advisor, one of the things that he criticizes very vociferously in his book is the very fact that JFK relied on a very small coterie of bosom buddies for his national security decision making. And that their National Security Council under him was essentially an echo chamber. So that's the first thing that's interesting about it. The second thing that I make about this is that there is a particular saying among some of the more intelligent counterinsurgents, the ones that are not just spouting off cliches. They say that counterinsurgency doctrine is supposed to be a series of tactical interventions when strategic decision-making has failed. And what they mean by strategic decision-making is that politicians or civilian politicians have failed at thinking through what the strategic aims of their military intervention might be. So what do I think of this in general? I'll give you two answers to that. The first answer is, from a policy perspective, he's absolutely right. I mean, of course, you have to know what you're doing. You have to have some sort of a strategic aim in mind, and that engagement in any form of military action has to be guided in some senses by knowing what the political outcomes are, but also by anticipating what the backlash, in fact, unintended consequences, feedback loops and whatnot will work. But that's quite a mainstream response. My position as a lefty is that, yes, of course, military officers have to feed back to the civilian politicians. And yes, very often military officers, if they are not figures a bit like the Jack Ripper figure in Dr. Strangelove, they tend to have a better sense of the cost of war. And yet, what makes this particular argument interesting is a kind of knowingness that military officers have a sort of an internal knowledge about what war is about, which exceeds the civilian political calculation. Now, the fact is that in the few instances where such an argument has been trotted out against the war, has been by counterinsurgents against U.S.'s involvement in the Vietnam War and by counterinsurgents against, in fact, U.S.'s involvement in Iraq. And my sense as a lefty is that they're not taking this position because they have some sort of a political sense of the injustice of such intervention or worries about imperial overextension, but rather the fear is of badly managed, badly fought wars and weak politicians who will make mistakes for which the military has to suffer.
Is there any truth in the analysis that the U.S. could have won the Vietnam War if we'd done it right?
Again, there are two answers to that question, but my sense is that no. One answer would be that, yes, you could fight a war well and you could win it. But my sense is, and in fact probably most military historians, but also historians that actually pay attention to the developments in politics and sociology and the political economy of places, is that these kinds of massive transformations in the politics of places that end up happening through war tend to be very unpredictable. And it doesn't matter how well you fight a war. There are particular moments in history where an imperial or a colonial power is never going to be able to win a war against an anti-colonial force. Even if you do have an initial win of some sort, it often has very major long-term consequences, which can be either instability in those regions, of course, stability being a social good some of these imperial or neo-imperial characters see as valuable, or in the long term, further violence. Could they have won in Vietnam? I really don't know. I'm not a historian of Vietnam War. My sense is that no, they could not have won. Just on the basis of military tactics, what was going on with both General Giap's work in North Vietnam and the Vietnamese National Liberation Movement, the way in which these people were fighting an anti-colonial war and the ferocity with which they believed in their cause, I don't think could have allowed for the U.S. to win, no matter what they would have done.
Well, it sort of feeds the Yahoo argument that we lost in Vietnam because we fought with one arm tied behind our back, was the popular phrase at the time. But I don't know, it seemed like history is against us on that.
That is a Yahoo argument. Interestingly, the counterinsurgent argument is not quite like that, and that is what makes them so interesting. The argument is not that you should have used more force. The argument, and this is it's very much a liberal argument, is that you should have fought better. And one of the factors that they keep pointing to is that instead of using disproportionate force, what you need to do is you need to win hearts and minds. This hearts and minds has become such a cliche, I'm loath to even bring it up. But the fact of the matter is that, for example, the person that they quote, a book by Neil Sheehan about the Vietnam War, there's a counterinsurgent, Vietnam era counterinsurgent in that figure. And what he argues, which is constantly quoted by everybody, is that the best way to fight a guerrilla force is not by air power. A little bit better is hand-to-hand by guns, but even better it's to fight them with a knife. And so it's not the disproportionate use of force they point to, but rather, first of all, a kind of a more attenuated sense of military force, but also other factors are huge in these forms of counterinsurgency thinking, and those are persuading civilians to come to your side and doing so through quote unquote, and I'm doing air quotes, inverted commas, protecting the civilians. Now, what protecting civilians often means is cutting them off from the guerrilla forces in order for them not to be able to provide any form of support or shelter or intelligence to the guerrilla forces, but at the same time, making them in some sense as a captive audience that can be mined for intelligence about those guerrilla forces. And this is, of course, what comes up in a lot of this work, and importantly, to take this conversation back to McMahon, in the ways in which he famously pacified the city of Tal Afar in the Anbar province in Iraq in 2005.
Yes, I did want to get back to McMaster's career, and that's what made him famous, right? The pacification of Tal Afar. Tell us that story.
Tal Afar is one of those cases which is often trotted out as being a major success story in the Iraq War. It's considered to be even more significant because it is considered to be a success at a time where there was a massive ramp up in resistance by both Islamists and former Ba'athists and other nationalist forces against the U.S. in Iraq. What has become canonical about what McMaster did in Tal Afar is that he engaged in two categories of activities. Some were military activities. These included building a massive wall, a sand berm, around the city and having very few entry points and exit points from the city so that you could control, this is called population control in counterinsurgency, it's part of that whole inverted comma protection of civilians, so that you could control who went in and who went out. And you had a very good eye in some senses on whether or not the people that you were looking at were civilian populations or insurgents. Of course, as you know, in unconventional warfare, it's very difficult to tell the difference between the two. So that was one of the things that he did. There were other kinds of military tactics he engaged in, including house-to-house reconnaissance and various other forms of intelligence gathering. Again, these have become canonical parts of counterinsurgency, the military side of counterinsurgency doctrine. So this is supposed to operate on the basis of three actions. The first two are military, clear and hold, and build. So clear and hold is when you clear out the city, build the wall, you try to root out the insurgents, and then the political stuff comes in at the build stage, at the latter stage. And this is perhaps where a lot of counterinsurgents put a lot of the emphasis of their work, because one of the ways in which also counterinsurgency tries to sell itself is that it being a political solution to a both political and military problem. And what they did in this political solution was to try to appeal to local elders, respected figures that were ambivalent about supporting the U.S. And these ambivalent figures were brought over and persuaded to work with the U.S., placed in a position, for example, as the mayor of Tal Afar, and in so doing allowed for a proxy political force in the city to continue the job of pacifying the city. There were some financial incentives given to these local proxies, which allowed for rebuilding, and of course some infrastructure spending in order to rebuild what was destroyed in the war, which of course, you know, provides both jobs and streams of income. And so there is a political way of pacifying the population through both these handouts and through co-opting local leaders, which is, you know, extremely well known from previous imperial conquests. These are not new things. It's just that the U.S. keeps relearning how to imperially control places it conquers militarily every war it engages in.
I'm Sunni Halala Khalili, a professor of Middle Eastern politics at the School of Oriental and Asian Studies at the University of London. The intellectual roots of counterinsurgency doctrine lie in strategies of colonial control, right?
Absolutely. I mean, this is, what is interesting about the counterinsurgency field manual, which is in some senses the text. In this, not only in the ways in which it operates on the ground for military guys, but it's the text as a kind of a resource for us to be able to trace the lineages of these thoughts, is that it has a lot of contemporary cases. And one of the ones that has given the most pages is, in fact, the Tal Afar case. But what they constantly harken back to are particularly the UK, the British counterinsurgency in Malaya, and the French counterinsurgency in Algeria. Although they make some lip service towards these being colonial interventions, and of course the U.S. is there to bring democracy and good stuff, there's also a very clear knowledge and acknowledgement that essentially these forms of military thinking, doctrines, theorizing had been first consolidated in the cauldron of anti-colonial struggles and colonial attempts at pacifying them.
This McMaster appointment has received good reviews from most of the pundit class. I was just reading Fred Kaplan in Slate, who also wrote a book on counterinsurgency, right?
Oh, yes.
What do you think the political impact of this McMaster appointment will be? Will it silence a lot of the national security criticisms of Trump so far?
Absolutely. There are several reasons for this. First of all, you mentioned Fred Kaplan. McMaster is the kind of character that has had more journalists write hagiographic accounts of his work and of himself than just about any of the others that I can think of, even more so than Petraeus, because in some ways the character that McMaster projects lends itself to an enormous amount of, forgive me for doing a little bit of a Freudian analysis there, but masculine is kind of projection and fantasy. He's different than Petraeus because he's a soldier's soldier. He looks it. He looks like a bulldog. He's big, but he is also unbelievably articulate. I'm not sure whether or not you've ever listened to him speak. And he's actually one of those people who can spin a one paragraph long sentence with multiple subclauses and never lose his place in it. And actually convey, like a lot of these guys, he can convey some basic cliche stuff, but there are also moments where he actually can be incredibly thought-provoking. I don't want to underestimate his intelligence. He's not a meathead, and I think that is something that anybody who is worried about this sort of thing has to be aware of. This is the number one thing. The second thing about it is he's been very careful. Again, he's very smart. He's been a very non-partisan figure, and what I mean by that is that while somebody like Flynn, for example, went to the GOP convention, was filmed shouting arrest Hillary, etc., etc., even Petraeus flirted with the GOP. As far as I know, McMaster has remained scrupulously out of politics. And now that probably has to do with the fact that he's still active service. He's still active duty and in service. And so he really can't speak about it. But he's also been very, very careful in any journalistic accounts or interviews or where he's been quoted not to say anything. And that means that a lot of these journalists and pundits who, of course, come from the Democratic side of the aisle, the national security Twitterverse and blogosphere, they love the fact that he has remained so scrupulously nonpartisan. That's the second thing that makes them such a clever choice. There are other factors that are really interesting. Where Flynn, for example, was caught out with speaking to the Russian officials, I think this is a kind of an overblown and ridiculous sort of situation, but I think this is the contrast between Flynn and McMaster makes this a very interesting choice. McMaster's most recent speech that I could find a film of online was at the policy exchange in London at the end of January, so about a month ago, in which he clearly articulates that the number one national security threat to the United States is Russia. And so in a way, he also fits perfectly within the orthodoxy that seems to be taking shape right now in liberal national security Twitterverse and blogosphere in the U.S.
One can only speculate on what motivates Trump's mind, a term one uses cautiously. But what do you suppose he wants from McMaster? Is it a more effective war against ISIS and intervention in Syria? What do you see his role in this administration? And will he be able to survive the lunacy around Trump?
Well, this is a very good question. So the first question is much more complex. Somebody who I know, a colleague in the U.S., yesterday mentioned on Facebook that he actually thinks that McMaster may have had no choice in being chosen for this position because he is still active duty. And when I asked, is that possible that you can have an active duty officer be appointed in some senses, whether or not they want to a national security advisor position, this colleague pointed out to me that apparently Colin Powell was national security advisor under Reagan as an active duty officer. And so it is possible that he has been chosen whether or not he wants to be put into that position precisely because he is this figure. I mean, if we think that there's some sort of a diabolical consolidation plan at work, not by Trump himself, which I agree with you, Trump's mind is probably as shallow as a puddle, but the people around him, then McMaster is a genius choice. Now, the thing about it is that there are also convergences between those shallow pronouncements that Trump has made and some of the particular ways in which McMaster thinks about waging war. Okay. Number one, Trump has been, he's changed his mind on this a little bit, but by and large, he has taken a position against enormous amounts of tech expenditure for the military. He has said stuff that has made the Boeing stock fall. He has said stuff that has made the Lockheed Martin stock fall. He has talked against the F-35 plane, etc., etc. And interestingly, McMaster is also one of those people who has been, throughout his career, very, very vocal of fetishization of what he calls exquisite warfighting technology. And he really is opposed to that. So in that way, they converge. I can see this being one of the ways in which McMaster is very congenial, or his way of thinking is congenial. The second thing is that both Trump and the people around him, as well as the new McCain white paper on the military, have essentially mentioned how the U.S. needs to expand its army. It's a kind of a job, the army as a job program, if you will. It's not military Keynesianism by handing money to military-industrial complex, but rather creating job program through recruitment into the military. And given the fact that McMaster is a boots-on-the-ground kind of guy, this also, there's a convergence between the ways in which he thinks and the ways in which the unconventional threat envisioned by the Trump administration, at least in the Middle East, can be addressed. But what is really interesting is that McMaster, to him, in that policy exchange talk, the other three major national security concerns that he has voiced, other four, are number one, Russia, as I mentioned, number two, China's expansion, number three, North Korea's nuclear power, and then number four, and this is quite interesting, is he mentioned something to the effect that the Iranian regime has been fighting a proxy war against the United States since 1979. So that is also another way in which McMaster seems to be fairly congenial to all the other characters in the national security circle in the White House currently, which is that the one thing they all share in common, regardless of their position, is that they all hate Iran. So it's not so much ISIS, I think, as all of these other factors in which there are convergences between McMaster and other figures in the White House currently.
All that counterinsurgency wisdom doesn't seem very relevant to fighting Russia or China, though.
Well, you say that, but one of the things that has been very interesting, I have this obsession with reading military primary sources, meaning military reviews and military doctrine and military magazines, and there are hundreds of them all the time. And one of the things that is very prevalent right now in military thinking is a concern about what they call hybrid wars, which they claim Russia to be very good at it. And what hybrid wars are, I suppose, is an update and a kind of inversion of the way in which Mao thought about protracted war. Mao thought that guerrilla warfare should be about having a guerrilla force that eventually becomes a kind of a conventional force and then fights alongside a conventional force, a more conventional force. Now, what the hybrid warfare is a kind of a 21st century updating of that, where you have a conventional military force, the Russian military force, fighting alongside proxy unconventional guerrilla forces in other places, and you've seen some of this in places like Ukraine, et cetera, et cetera. And so the hybrid warfare thing actually lends itself extremely well to counterinsurgency stuff. But there's, as I said, there's also the domestic payoff of having somebody like McMaster, which is that somebody who agrees to recruitment of more and more people into the army, which is a kind of a job program that Trump has in mind.
And finally, I notice a lot of liberals, when we mention this, a lot of liberals are placated by the appointment of McMaster. But should we be more worried? Is this guy more effective than a lunatic like Flynn?
Well, it's quite interesting. A lot of liberals are worried, but Financial Times' Gideon Ruffman, who's been a very major critic of Trump, had his headline of his Financial Times thing was that this actually normalizes Trump. So there's some worry about that among some liberals. My concern is that, yes, he is a very effective imperial administrator. A bumbling imperial administration could also have massive costs, but on the other hand, it also means that it is going to be ineffective in advancing a set of goals, whereas McMaster is a very effective person. That said, from everything that one hears about the ways in which White House is run, compounded by the fact that they have very, very few bureaucrats in place in any of the major agencies or nominated personnel that need to be confirmed, tells me that doesn't matter how incredibly effective he is going to face an enormous lot of problems, including perhaps continued conflict with Steve Bannon, who's got his strategic initiatives group as a kind of a rival force to the National Security Council. I think where McMaster really does placate the liberals and also perhaps is used as a kind of a calming factor is that he is very pro-NATO. And so in that way, his being brought in placates the U.S.'s military allies and NATO overseas more than anything else.
That was Lale Khalili of the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London. After we recorded the interview, I watched a video of a talk that McMaster gave in 2014 at the Carnegie Endowment for Ethics and International Affairs. Good God, the things that liberals come up with. Get an American general to talk about ethics. If you can get past the distracting array of medals on his chest, you'll find that he's a very smart and articulate guy, a highly skilled technician of empire, which makes him in some sense scarier than a loon like Flynn. You do have to wonder where the Trump administration is going. He's got serious conservatives, people with hard right politics who know what they're doing, people like Pence as VP, Sessions as Attorney General, and Price of Health and Human Services. He's got people with hard right politics who don't know what they're doing, like DeVos at Education. He's got nuts with indescribable politics like Bannon as minister without portfolio. And he's got establishment figures like McMaster. And at the top of it all, you've got the vicious ignoramus Trump. How will it all work out? That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this. Nazis from the 1980s East German punk band Nominlos, which means nameless. Just to be clear, they're against them. Till next week. Bye.